So thank you very much, Timmy, and thank you to Stan Smith. Thank you so much, Stan, and to all of the sponsoring groups tonight. It's great to see a good crowd here. I think it's been a tough week, or is it a tough couple of months, or is it tough over a year?
A couple of years.
Almost 2 years, yeah. It's a tough time. And sometimes we've got to just take a deep breath and recognize that with all the bad things that are going on, there are some good things too, like the elections in Mexico. Like the election of this wonderful Alexandria Costa, Ocasio-Cortez in New York City. And I think a really wonderful thing is all the people who came out on the streets on Saturday throughout this country in marches where there were tens of thousands of people, even in some of the smaller cities. And I think here in Chicago, you had about, what?
60,000
in the heat, boys.
Yeah,
so anybody here who was out at the march? So let's give them all a hand for being out there. So in the midst of all of this, when you look at some of the foreign policy issues, I want to start out talking about an issue that I think a number of people, even in the progressive community and certainly in the sort of liberal Democrat sphere, are very confused about, and that is North Korea. So I have spent quite a number of times going to South Korea and even to the North with a group called Women Cross the DMZ. DMZ stands for Demilitarized Zone, which is a total misnomer because it's the most militarized zone in the world. And we were one of the few groups that got permission to go to the North and meet with women's groups there. We then walked across the DMZ into the South. And this was in 2015, and I was just back again in May. In 2015, when we went there was so much animosity towards us when we got to the South, just because we had been in the North. And when we crossed over, there were these lines of police waiting for us, and they said, you're going to need guards, police guards, everywhere you go now, because there are people who hate you. And indeed, we did a press conference, and there were people there who hated us. They said we were puppets of North Korea just because we had stepped into North Korea. They said there were people who wanted to throw acid in our faces because we were proposing a rapprochement with the North. And the sentiment was not only animosity by a sector of the population, but fear by the others about being associated with us. So imagine just 3 years later when Donald Trump is meeting with Kim Jong-un, and we were there again with this group of international women when Donald Trump said he was not going to do the summit. And they went out on the streets and they went to the US Embassy and they protested. And lo and behold, the next day when we were doing our walk to the demilitarized zone again, the heads of state of the North and South were there meeting to figure out how to get things back on track. So we have to understand that the reason for the talks in North Korea now is because of the South. Totally because of the South. Not because of Donald Trump, not because of Kim Jong-un, because of the South. And let me just explain that because it's relevant to the talk I want to give on Iran, which is that the people of South Korea are very active, very feisty, a lot of civil society there, and they were protesting against their corrupt government starting in November of 2016. And they would go out into the streets every single night in something called the Candlelight Vigil. And the Candlelight Vigil started spreading all around the country against the corrupt government of President Park at that time. And as this grew and grew, by March of 2017, One out of every three people in South Korea had been out at those protests. That's extraordinary. That's over 15 million people out on the streets. And what did they want? They wanted to impeach a corrupt president. Yay! Sound like a good idea? But in their case, they managed actually to impeach a corrupt president. And then they held elections. And what has been called a miracle of democracy, they elected somebody, President Moon, not only on a ticket to wipe out corruption, but also to make peace with the North. And so he has a huge mandate and has an over 80% approval rating among the people of South Korea. It is quite extraordinary to see that momentum. And so when we were there that day, the Donald Trump said no, and then it was on again. The people of South Korea that we were meeting with had the same message for us. They said, the peace train has left the station, whether Donald Trump is on it or not. We are moving forward with peace. And that's a beautiful thing to know. And for those of us who have all kinds of reasons to dislike Donald Trump, in the case of North Korea, we have to say that we love peace more than we dislike Donald Trump. And we've got to support this peace process with North Korea. And right now, I think that deserves some applause, actually. Right now, raise your hand if you've heard any comments in the last day or two about how the North Koreans are already cheating and yeah. So, you know, first of all, they might well be. I would think they probably are, you know, trying to find ways that they can delay this process as much as possible. But you have to understand a couple of things. One is there are vested interests in keeping the conflict going on the peninsula. And those vested interests include the military-industrial complex, the companies that make many billions of dollars in all of these weapon systems. There are vested interests among the analysts and the think tanks that want to constantly, you know, keep their jobs going by keeping the conflict going. There are vested interests in the Democratic Party of finding all kinds of ways to beat up on Trump. And there are certainly people in the North and the South that want to keep the status quo. And so when you see these kind of reports, it's important to think who is behind it. And one thing I looked at when I analyzed all of these reports that were coming out, they were all anonymous sources. So you had anonymous intelligence officers talking to anonymous U.S. officials. And this is what they came up with. So be wary of the kind of things you heard. Also recognize that for the people of South Korea, at least, their interests, when I have talked to them and things I've read from them, is not number one about denuclearization. And of course, there's questions what that means. Does that mean just North Korea has to denuclearize? Or does that mean that the U.S. has to denuclearize as well? And certainly when it comes to the umbrella that is for South Korea. But the other issue really is to look at, for the people of South Korea and the North, they want to stop living in a state of fear. They want to calm down Donald Trump, who had ramped things up so much. And they want to start things like family reunification, rebuilding the economic trade zone that existed between the North and the South, people-to-people ties like we saw at the Olympics. And those kind of things are happening. So that's what they mean when they say the peace train has left the station. And I think that's what we have to be pushing as people who love peace more than we dislike Donald Trump. So I say all this as preface to talking about Iran, because while I am really supportive and very excited about the peace process with North Korea, it is extremely ironic that Donald Trump has chosen to meet with and make peace with the leader of what is perhaps the most, most authoritarian regime in the world, North Korea, while he is moving us down the path of war with a regime that, in comparison, is certainly much more democratic and much more open to a process of de-escalation. And so when we talk about the issues around Iran, let's put it in the context that what is happening with North Korea should really be happening with Iran as well. And in a more rational world with a more rational leader at the helm, the U.S. would be moving towards more normal relationships with Iran. When I did this book on Iran, I did it to counter this notion that has been said that war is the way that Americans learn geography. And unfortunately, that has been very true in our past. And I thought it was important that we learn more about the geography, the culture, the history of Iran as a means to stop us from going to war. And I wonder, are there any people here from Iran? We have Sarah, we have a couple of people in the back and here. So when we go to the discussion, I look forward to hearing from you. And I must say, I want to apologize in my book for the short shrift I give to over 2,500 years of culture and history of this amazing part of our world. And is there anybody who is not of Iranian descent but who has been to Iran? Just a couple of people. I wonder if you would agree with me that you're kind of in awe when you go to Iran to see the beauty of the architecture, the old plazas, the mosques, you kind of look and say, who could have done this and how could they have done it? It's so stunning. And the literature and the poetry and the love that people of Iran have for their poets and the food, and there's just so much beauty in that culture. But I give it short shrift because I really want in the book to move towards more modern times, because that is really key to understanding where we are today. And the key is to talk about the years of the Shah in the 1900s, when the U.S. was actually a close ally of the government of Iran, just as the Western countries were as well. And one of the reasons was the openness of the Shah to giving away the keys to the major resources of that country, particularly oil. And the Shah government had given the concession for the oil to a British company, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company that became BP. And this is something that many Iranians were unhappy about. And so they did what people are supposed to do. They organized, they mobilized, and they voted in somebody, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1951, on a platform to nationalize the nation's oil. And indeed, he came in with that mandate and started to implement that mandate. The British were very upset about it, convinced the United States that this was a terrible thing, not only for the British oil company, but also the example that it was setting to other resource-rich nations. And so the U.S., the CIA came in and orchestrated a coup in 1953 to overthrow the democratically elected government of Iran. Now, it's important to look at the context in which that happened. One is to understand that it was considered very, very successful at the time. Indeed, that covert action by the CIA was considered so successful that it was used the next year in 1954 in the case of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. It was used a couple of years later to overthrow Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. It was tried in 1961 to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba, and on and on and on. And it's quite ironic that you look at all the discontent around Russians meddling in our elections, when basically this has been the modus operandi of the United States for many, many decades, not just interfering but overthrowing democratically elected governments. So the Shah was brought back in and became even more repressive and disbanded any groups that had been organizing against the Shah, civil society, killed people, put them in prison, forced them into exile, used the resources, the oil resources, to buy more and more weapons. In fact, by 1969, Iran had become the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons, and that continued into the 70s, and the weapons were used to repress his own people. And so people were trying to organize and mobilize under this very repressive situation, and a lot of the organizing was being done overseas. But there was really only one place where people could organize more openly within the country, and that was in the mosques. And that's why the clerics became so powerful. And so when the Shah was finally overthrown in 1979, there was tremendous conflict over what the next government would look like. There were many people who had been organized against the Shah, and I don't know if any of our Iranians here were part of that movement. So there are some people in this community who were part of that movement, and many of them were progressives, leftists, socialists, Marxists. There is a strong tradition in Iranian history of socialism. There have been strong socialist parties over the years. And during this internal conflict over who would rule, the clerics gained the upper hand, and the conservative clerics, because there was a lot of difference among the clerics themselves. They formed a government where the supreme leader, who was Ayatollah Khomeini at that point, gained tremendous power. And in the intervening years, a government was set up that had a hybrid of clerics having a lot of power, but also some more democratic institutions that manifested themselves in elections, for example. And it does make a difference who wins in those elections. They are not free and fair elections because not anybody can run. It has to be vetted by a guardian council. But it does make a difference if it's a conservative who wins, if it's a more moderate faction. And there is a lot of organizing and mobilizing around elections. In the book, I talk a lot about the lack of freedoms within Iran, the lack of freedom of association, of freedom of speech, the lack of freedom of religion. There is freedom of religion for some. For example, you might not know, but that for Jewish people in Iran, they do have freedom. In fact, I was first worried about saying that I was Jewish when I went to Iran until I realized that Iranians love Jews. You know, if the conservatives think we are the same people of the book and have a lot in common, and actually got a little upset with me when I said that I was not a practicing Jew. And the secular folks say, oh, we love Jewish cinema and Jewish culture and Jewish sense of humor. And indeed, there are synagogues and there are delis and there are kosher butchers and there is a given representative in the assembly that is for the Jewish community. But if you are a Baha'i, for example, you do not get that same kind of openness. And so I talk about the repression on certain groups as well as minority groups. But I do think that it's important to recognize that changes have occurred since 1979. It's not a static society. What has been pretty static, though, has been the U.S. animosity. So when the 1979 revolution happened, some of you might remember what took place soon after that when Jimmy Carter allowed the Shah to come into the United States, and many people that were involved in overthrowing the Shah thought that they were getting ready to institute another coup. The students took over the U.S. Embassy, kept 52 Americans hostage for a long time, 444 days. And it was during that time that the U.S. cut off relations with Iran. Those relations have never been restored. It was also during that time that the U.S. imposed sanctions, and those sanctions have been in place in one form or another during all of those decades. So fast forward to Barack Obama. And one of, I think, the signature achievement of the Obama campaign was the Iran nuclear deal. Because it was so important to lower the tensions with Iran and also try to use that as a springboard to talk about other issues, which is precisely what John Kerry, the Secretary of State at the time who was doing the negotiations, wanted to happen. And so the negotiations were really important, were successful after a long, long, hard period of negotiations. Finally, in March of 2015, the deal was signed not only by the U.S. and Iran, but also by the British, French, Germans, Chinese, and Russians. And not only that, it was signed by the entire European Union and then passed unanimously at the U.N. Security Council. But there was one fatal flaw in that agreement. And it's not what Trump says, that it didn't have a sunset clause or it didn't include other issues. The fatal flaw is that it was not a formal treaty. And it wasn't a formal treaty because with the partisanship that was going on during the Obama years, he did not think he could get the votes in the Senate to pass it. Because a treaty in the U.S. is not just a simple majority, it's a two-thirds. So he made it an executive agreement instead of a treaty, which meant that Donald Trump could do what he did, which was during the entire campaign talk about what a terrible deal it was, and then as soon as he could, once he was in office, to pull the U.S. out of that deal. And so let's look at the sides that Donald Trump has sided with. It's not with the Europeans, the Chinese, and the Russians, and basically the world community that wants to keep that deal because they said that it was a good deal, that Iran was complying with the deal. In fact, if you look at the International Atomic Energy Association, the organization that was doing the monitoring, they had 10 different reports out since 2015 saying that Iran was indeed complying. But Donald Trump did not want to listen to the IAEA or the other countries. Who he wanted to listen to was Bibi Netanyahu from Israel. Israel had never wanted a deal with Iran. In fact, John Kerry said that while he was negotiating, he was being pressured constantly by the Israelis who said, don't negotiate, bomb Iran instead. And to think of the gall, or we might say the chutzpah, of Bibi Netanyahu to come before the U.S. Congress and the public and to try to out Iran and saying Iran was not complying by using old information that was really information that formed the basis of why the treaty was done to begin with. Let's remember that Iran has how many nuclear weapons?
Zero.
Zero. Absolutely zero. And Israel?
200 or something?
200 or something? I don't know. They don't tell us. Exactly. All of those are correct. Because Israel has been lying since the 1960s about its nuclear program. And Israel refused to join the non-proliferation treaty like Iran did. Israel would never allow any inspectors in. And so the country that is the biggest liar in terms of their nuclear weapons is the one trying to out the Iranians. Now, I don't know about you. I don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, but I don't want any country to have nuclear weapons, not only Israel, but the United States as well. But we have to see this from the perspective of other people. And so when I say, who is it that Donald Trump is siding with? He's siding with Bibi Netanyahu. He's siding with the Saudis, The Saudi leadership, the crown prince, also did not want the U.S. to sign an agreement with Iran. And he's siding with the conservatives in Iran, who never wanted the Iranian government to negotiate either, who said, why should we negotiate? Other countries don't do this. Why should we negotiate? Because the United States is untrustworthy. And indeed, they were right, because we signed a deal, and then the deal was unsigned. So you have the situation where Donald Trump is siding with Israel, Saudi Arabia, the conservatives inside Iran, against the world community. And so what's happened is that the Iran nuclear deal is now hanging on by life support. The other countries want to stay in the deal. But will Iran stay in the deal? Iran is supposed to have benefited from this deal. The economy was supposed to have gotten better. But when Donald Trump decided that the U.S. was going to pull out, the value of the local currency, the real, has plummeted. Prices have gone sky high. People are very unhappy. And this is part of the plan of the U.S. government, which is just like Henry Kissinger said in 1973 when we were going, when the U.S. government plotted to overthrow the government of Salvador Allende in Chile, the goal was to make the economy scream. And that's exactly what they're doing in Iran. Because the U.S. is saying not only to U.S. companies, you can't trade with Iran, and any deals you might have started to negotiate in the last 2 years, you better tear those up. They're saying to the rest of the world, if you want any dealings with the U.S. or changing any of your international deals, dollar exchanges in the dollar, which is basically the international currency, then you better not deal with Iran. Now, the Europeans have been very upset about this. The German U.S. ambassador to Germany, who started his job on May 18th, the first thing he did was, a la Donald Trump, put out a tweet. And instead of saying, hello, I am your new ambassador to Germany. You have a lovely country, and I'm so honored to be representing the United States here. Instead, he put out a tweet that said, Donald Trump has said that your companies better tear up the deals that they have with Iran and stop trading with them immediately. And so some of the papers in Germany said, on the first day of the job, the U.S. ambassador becomes the most hated person in Germany. but the question is, can they or will they buck Donald Trump on this one? And as much as they are talking tough, the Europeans have a lot of other issues that are more important right now. The immigration issues, tariff trade wars with Donald Trump, all kinds of other issues. So do they want to take this one on as well? And more importantly, do their companies want to risk the U.S. sanctions? And the answer to that is no. And we've already seen that. There are companies from the oil company like Total, the auto company like Renault, the commercial airplanes like Airbus. They had multi-million and some multi-billion dollar trade deals that they were negotiating with Iran. And they have torn those up already. They said, we just don't want to face potential U.S. sanctions. It is not worth it for us. So that's why the Iranian government is in a very difficult position right now. And there's a lot of pressure on the Iranian government from many sides. I said that people were discontent. We saw at the end of last year, in December and then in January, protests that were happening in many cities around Iran. And now we see protests happening as well right now. And I know Sarah and I talked before. She just came back. She said how miserable people are, how difficult the economic situation is. And I talk to Iranians a lot. And I look forward to the discussion with you here today. But what I hear mostly from Iranians is, certainly there are some people who still want to stick with the Iranian government. There are many, many people who don't like the government. But their question is, what is the alternative right now? And they look around at Iraq. They see the total chaos in Iraq. They look at Libya. They see the disaster in Libya. They look at Syria. They see the disaster there. They said, is that what our future is? And then they look at who would come in and take control. Well, the U.S. government has its own ideas. And this is particularly John Bolton, who was brought in by Donald Trump and always, always a hawk about Iran, said back several years ago when he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times with the title that said, to stop Iran's bombs, bomb Iran. And he is very close to a group that is called the MEK. So the MEK is a group that actually had legitimacy before the overthrow of the Shah because they were part of the mobilizations to get rid of the Shah. But once that happened and they lost out in terms of who would take control, a number of them went into exile, were killed, and some of them went over to next door to Iraq. Well, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980. And it led to a bloody, bloody 8-year war in which at least 500,000 people on each side were killed. The MEK was with Saddam Hussein, being armed and trained by Saddam Hussein to go back into Iran and blow things up. And indeed, they did. They were suicide bombers. They blew up lots of civilians. And they lost legitimacy among the vast majority of the Iranian people, and that continues today. And not only that, they are considered to be a cult-like organization, with one woman who is the be-all and end-all, supposedly has a husband, we can talk about this, he supposedly died, but she still quotes him as if he's still alive. They are an organization that was on the U.S. terrorist list until 2012 when they had a lot of money that they put into buying off U.S. politicians to win support. And it is rumored that that money comes from Saudi Arabia. And among the politicians they have bought off are people from the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, liberals, conservatives, and a lot of them speak at the MEK gatherings with tremendous fees that they get for speaking. John Bolton himself, according to the MEK, has received $180,000 in speaking fees. And just this weekend, they had a gathering in Paris where they have their headquarters. And at the gathering in Paris were people like Newt Gingrich, people like Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani just loves the MEK. And he says to them, as John Bolton has said to them, we will be back in Iran next year. So they are trying to pave the way for this group that has basically no legitimacy on the ground. This might sound familiar to some of you who followed before the U.S. invaded Iraq. We did the exact same thing. Picked our favorite group, Ahmad Chalabi at that point, and others who mostly were in the diaspora, had not lived in Iraq for a long time, created a group and said, this is who we are going to put in power. And let's think about how well that worked. And that was so disastrous that how can we allow them to do the same thing all over again now? So where is this leading? The confrontations with Iran could take place anywhere. There are proxy wars now going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They're happening in Yemen. They're happening in Syria. They're happening inside Iraq itself. The Israelis are already attacking Iranians in Syria. They are trying to drag the U.S. into a war. And perhaps the more cool heads are within the Pentagon itself. It's interesting that James Mattis was somebody who is known to be very much against the Iranian government. In fact, just a few years ago, before he was in office under Trump, he was asked, what are the biggest threats to the United States? And he said, Iran, Iran, Iran. But now that he's in that position, it seems that there is a lot of dissent between him and John Bolton about how to move forward. And why? Because Mattis knows what a catastrophic situation it could be if we indeed move down to a path with war with Iran. There are many different ways it could go, and they all look bad. Don't think that the Iranian government is just sitting by, twiddling its fingers, wondering if the U.S. is going to invade. No. They have very strong, they have a million people under arms, they have plans. They are surrounded by U.S. bases and also by a piece of water where a lot of the world's oil goes through that they could try to stop. They could attack U.S. forces in many different countries surrounding Iran. Their allies, Hezbollah and Lebanon, could attack U.S. allies like Israel. They could make things very difficult for the U.S. in neighboring Iraq, where they have Shia militias that respond to Iran. So there are many ways that this could go very, very bad. So it looks like the U.S. does not have any kind of realistic plan B except total chaos inside Iran. And some people say that's what the Israelis would like, that what they want is for civil war in Iran. They want the minority groups to be fighting for independence. They want to see Iran broken up, like Iraq broken up into three pieces. They want a weak nation next to them, not one nation of 80 million people. But let's recognize that we are moving down a path that, as bad as things are now for people in Iran, could get much, much worse. And the entire region could get worse than it is. And we can debate what we think Iran's role in the region is right now, but one thing is certain, without Iran at the table, the conflicts in the Middle East will not get any better. They'll only get worse. And so my plea is that we do more to educate people, to mobilize people, because guess what? In Congress, there is not a lot of support for stopping a war with Iran. AIPAC, the largest foreign policy group, pro-Israel group, has made people in Congress really afraid to speak out for a non-aggressive policy towards Iran. There is a group called NIAC, the National Iranian Council. They've done a very good job so far on trying to win support for the Iran nuclear deal. But now they are overwhelmed by something else, which is that Iran is part of the groups that were put on the Muslim ban. And let's just think about that for a minute, because I don't know about you, I don't think there should be any country on a ban. But if there was a real rationale about putting countries on a ban, one would wonder why Saudi Arabia is not on that ban, the country that provided 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11. And Iranians have provided zero people who've ever done a terrorist attack inside the United States. And yet, Iran is on that ban, which is devastating for many hundreds of thousands of Iranians in this country who are worried now, will they be able to see their families? Will their families be able to come here? If they're students, are they able to come home and then go back again? It is devastating for the Iranian community. So it's hard to find a constituency in Washington, D.C. that can really advocate for a peaceful resolution of the conflict. And that's why we need the grassroots. That's why we're passing around a sign-up sheet here. If you haven't signed up, please do, because we need to work together on this. Is there anybody who hasn't had a chance to sign? And then we'll pass it in the back as well. And lastly, I just want to mention a couple of things that are happening. There have been resolutions put forward to reiterate what is in the Constitution, which is the president is not allowed to wage war. This is the authority of the legislative branch. There are efforts to say part of our being able to ease up the situation in Iran would be to create some more daylight between us and Saudi Arabia. And so the effort to stop the weapon sales to Saudi Arabia that are being used to crush the people of Yemen is something that's very important for us to work on. Efforts that we can do to create some more daylight between the United States and the Israeli government would help as well. And then whatever we can do to humanize the Iranian people. And so part of what we're anxious to do is find ways that we can, we're asking for permission inside Iran to bring people for a peace walk. We want to get groups around the country to be doing cultural activities. There's so much beauty in the Iran movies and in the literature. And to think of, we have some Iranian poets who want to work with us on poetry exchanges, anything we can do to show the Iranians as real people would be very helpful. And in that vein, I just want to end with a quote that somebody sent to me that's from a man who unfortunately is no longer with us, and that is Anthony Bourdain. Because I think Anthony Bourdain did something that is so important for the American people, which is to bring the people around our world and even people in our own country into our living rooms so that we can understand them better, that we can love them more. And in the case of Iran, he wrote this: "Iran was mind-blowing. My crew has never been treated so well by total strangers everywhere. We had heard that Persians were nice, but the nicest? We never saw that coming." So let us, in the vein and in the memory of Anthony Bourdain, try to learn a lot more about Iran, its people, its culture, its beauty, so that we don't go to war with the Iranian people. Thank you so much. Thank you both, and I think it's an example of how, just like in this country, there's a lot of division inside Iran and outside Iran about how to think about the government. But the important thing is to think about what is our responsibility. And our responsibility is to let the Iranian people decide their own future and to stop our government from intervening.
But the Western press is telling me that right now in Syria, the Russians and the Iranians and the Syrian government are pounding the opposition. I don't happen to care for the opposition, but I wonder if you could help me understand why Iran is so busy doing this in the midst of the Iranian crisis.
Well, the U.S. Defense Department has done a number of studies, and I quote in the book, looking at Iran's foreign policy, and unlike the way it's portrayed by the Trump administration, they say it is defensive because Iran feels like it is surrounded by hostile neighbors, just like Israel feels it's surrounded by hostile neighbors. Iran is a majority Shia society surrounded by majority Sunni societies, including extremist groups that, thanks to the Saudis, have spread throughout the region. And so Iran, in trying to stop those extremist groups from coming inside Iran, is fighting outside of Iran and shoring up what it thinks are its allies, whether it's Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Syrian government or the Houthis in Yemen. And so we see these proxy wars being carried out. I want to go back to what I said earlier, which is that I think that we have to not only stop a war in Iran, but we've got to be supportive of peace processes in the region. And the only way that's going to happen is if everybody is at the table. And that's Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, the U.S., Turkey, all of them. And so the way the U.S. is working right now to try to isolate Iran from any kind of involvement in the conflicts in the region is just going to increase them.
So what are our, looking at the long game here, what are U.S. interests in Iran long term, other than the wonderful connections that we have with our friends? And also, what about China? I'm very curious. China still needs Iran. China is Iran's largest trading partner, and that's my area of study.
You bring up very important points. The one country that is benefiting from the U.S. reimposition of sanctions is China. China was the largest trading partner of Iran, and now it's becoming, Iran is becoming absolutely dependent on China. Iran sells its oil to China, to South Korea, to India, Turkey, and the U.S. is going to South Korea, India, Turkey, saying, we don't want you to buy any more Iranian oil. And this means that Iran has become more and more dependent on the Chinese. It also means that they get worse prices because there is no competition there. And so the Chinese become more influential. It is quite ironic that this is as a result of Trump's policies. And it is worrisome to a lot of our European friends who don't want to see that happening, but see it as pretty inevitable right now. So I think you're absolutely right in terms of what's happening with the oil market right now. The U.S. has become self-sufficient thanks to things like fracking. The Saudis are all too happy to comply with U.S. requests to increase production to make up for a decline in Iranian prices. Nonetheless, U.S. consumers and people around the world are already suffering from higher oil prices. In fact, it's been said that for every U.S. consumer in the United States, you are paying about $200 more this summer just because of the conflict that has not by any means played itself out yet. So it is a disastrous situation for the Iranian people. It's hurting consumers around the world, and it's benefiting China.
What happened with Mossadegh happened when I was a little kid, and I'm wondering if you'd mind elaborating. Was he actually murdered?
No, he was never murdered. Oh. He was actually, in the end, put under house arrest. And his home continues to be a place where people flock to. Many Iranians consider him like the Gandhi of Iran. And there are celebrations every year where people go to his house. So he was never murdered, but he was certainly put out of commission.
There was an Algiers accord that was signed. The hostages were let go. And the U.S. was supposed to reestablish relationships with Iran. Never been done. From 79 till now, next year I guess it'll be 40 years, four decades.
Well, as I said, there have been sanctions on Iran constantly in what, as you rightly say, would be 40 years. And they have been in many different forms, but never as incredibly harmful as they are today.
I want to ask you to comment on the relationship between the Iranian government and the current government of Iraq.
So when the U.S. is criticizing Iran for meddling in the region, it's quite funny because Iran is in the region. The U.S. has been meddling in the region for all too long. But the reason that Iran has more influence in the region is precisely because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And it was the U.S. invasion of Iraq that took a Sunni-led Saddam Hussein government, and at that time when it was replaced was a Shia government that was friendly to Iran. Since then, there have been changes in Iraq, more friendly to Iran, less friendly to Iran. Right now, there's a government that's a bit less friendly to Iran. But let's remember, it is a Shia government in Iraq that is empowered, and there are Shia militias that have close ties with the Revolutionary Guard in Iran really can be used by Iran to cause problems in Iraq if they want to do that. So it's very interesting that now you might remember the Sadr movement, which is now part of the government in Iraq and has been critical of both the United States and of Iran. Nevertheless, I would say there are strong ties in the Iraqi government with Iran because of the Shia connection.
What is the role of a country like Iran threatening to do away with using the U.S. dollar?
Thank you for that nice comment about us in the halls of Congress, but I sort of want to go back to this what this woman had said back there, because I don't think we disagree. I actually think we agree. And I'm in the halls of Congress, no matter if it's Democrats in power or Republicans in power, because I think both of them are sold out to big corporations and to big lobby groups, and neither of the main parties either represents us or the kind of foreign policy we would like to see our government have. In response to the second part, which was...
The U.S. dollar.
The U.S. dollar. You know, any time there has been a threat, like Saddam Hussein said he didn't want to trade oil with the U.S. dollar, and then he was gone. Yeah. Gaddafi as well. And now when we talked about the Chinese being the ones in power, they are the ones that have banks that have no dependence on the U.S. I mean, some of their banks, a lot of their banks do, but they have created special banks that are totally insulated from the U.S. dollar. So I really think as we move forward, we're going to see that China has become more and more powerful, the Chinese currency will become more and more powerful, and there'll be way more international trade. While the U.S. was insulting U.S. allies in Canada, the Chinese were meeting in Singapore with other Asian countries. And basically, they were going to move forward to go beyond the U.S. currency. As countries become more and more angry with the United States over their policies, they're going to have to look for alternatives to the dollar. Yes, yes, which might well happen.
So the wild card that I see here is Russia. Can you talk about how Putin might be the card holder here? He certainly has put a big cog in the wheel in Syria.
I think you're right in that it's a wild card, and we don't know, because the Russians have also been meeting with the Israelis. They've been trying to be mediators in some of this conflict. And they are also gaining monetarily from the problem with Iran, because the price of oil is going way back up now. And certainly Russia is one of those countries that benefits, as does, of course, Saudi Arabia. So I think Russia is trying to position itself, just as it did in Syria, as a major player. And who knows what Donald Trump and Putin will be talking about, but certainly Iran will be one of the issues on the list.
What will be the implication of this meeting to the policies in Iran between U.S. and Russia?
As far as will this meeting be good, you know, I tend to be of the thinking that it is good for leaders of countries to get together and talk to each other. I don't have any illusions about Putin, or about his control over Russia, or about trying to influence U.S. policy. But I do believe that Russia is a major player, and that it would be good for the world if there were good relations between the U.S. and Russia, just as it would be good for the world if there were good relations between the U.S. and the Iranian government. I'm extremely critical of the Saudis, and I wrote a whole book about how horrendous the Saudis are, but I want to see the U.S. Leaders meeting together. I think it's much better than fighting with each other. So I don't know what will come out of that summit in terms of Iran, but I do know, as we just said earlier, that you know, Russia is extremely involved in the region, has its own interests and influence in the region. And I would hope that what could come out of it is convincing Donald Trump that going to war with Iran would not be a good thing. If you listen to the interviews that Putin has done, you will hear him speaking very rationally about how it's good for the world economy if there is an end to the wars in the Middle East, if there is stability in the Middle East, if there is economic development that could benefit the region and the countries in the surrounding areas. They are worried about minority groups within Russia itself, just like the fomenting of separatist movements in Iran is bad for the Russians as well. So I think there is a lot of reasons why Russia would prefer to have a stable Iran.
I believe war is not the answer. Peace is. Talking to people that are disagreeing with us is hard, but it needs to be done.
I think one is to get over a lot of the differences that we have in terms of tactics and recognize that nobody's got the answer, so let's try it all. And those who believe that we can change in the electoral system, I say, let's get out people to vote in November and let's try to change the Congress. Those who don't believe in the electoral system, I say, whether or not we have a change in Congress, we need stronger grassroots movements that can pressure anybody who's in power to do the right thing. And we have the beginnings of that. We saw the people who came out on the streets on Saturday. You know, this opposition to the separation of families has been so strong that Donald Trump, who never likes to admit he was wrong, had to come out and say, okay, we're not going to separate families. Do we believe him? Well, you know, there's the trust but verify. I think this in the case is never trust and verify. But there is a movement. There's a real movement about that. And let me just give you one example. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. You know, the Jimmy Carter visited Iran right 6 months before the revolution in 1979 and said Iran was the most stable country in the Middle East. It is very hard to predict what things will happen, not only in Iran, but in our own country. We did not see what happened in New York coming with Joe Crowley, who's number four in the Democratic Party, got beat by a 28-year-old socialist. And I think that the way that the position around abolish ICE has gone in 1 month from an extremely fringe position, somebody would say abolish ICE, you'd say, yeah, right, to now a position where Kristen Gillibrand, who is a liberal Democrat with ambitions to be president, has sat down with us, the women, on Thursday in the Capitol to applaud all the people getting arrested and came out and said, I believe that ICE should be abolished. So she is following the wave of public opinion. And now she is introducing a bill, and there's a bill in the House. And so what is unthinkable, you know, a few weeks ago becomes where the momentum is now. So I say don't give up. Don't trash anybody else because of the tactics that they want to use. If somebody's going out and registering people to vote, all the power to them. You know, if somebody's going to get up there in their 20s and say, I'm going to challenge this guy who's been in office for decades, say all the power to you. In fact, here's my contribution. And if people are going to be out there calling for sit-ins, die-ins, blockades, civil disobedience, we should be putting our bodies on the line as well.
What's going on in Yemen? Because I don't really believe in the newspapers. I'm curious about like what the Houthis are about. And generally, it seems pretty senseless the way we're just killing them for no reason. So I was wondering if you had a theory about the motives and what the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are trying to get out of it.
Thank you for asking about that. It's not only senseless, it's absolutely criminal. You have a group that Houthis, which is an indigenous, large tribal group that felt that it was not getting its share of the power. And we can criticize them for taking up arms and taking over the capital. And supposedly the Iranians, because they are close religiously, told them not to do that. They went ahead and they did it. And lo and behold, it was very successful and they got rid of Hadi, who was in power, that was supposed to be just a transition government. And he ran off to Saudi Arabia. And he said to the Saudis, come help me, I need your help. And so he brought Saudi Arabia in, the, at that time, 30-year-old crown prince, who was in charge of the military, thought, okay, we're going to go in a couple of weeks, we're going to wipe out this ragtag Houthi group. And lo and behold, it's 3 years later. And the Saudi bombing with U.S. airplanes, U.S. refueling, U.S. logistics, U.S. diplomatic cover has created the largest catastrophe in the entire world. And right now, the Saudi and Emirati coalition is trying to take over the most important port in Yemen, which is the port of Hudaydah, where about 80% of the country's commercial, humanitarian, and fuel comes in. And right now, there are talks day and night going on at the UN to try to stop them from advancing. They've already taken over the airport. They're wanting to take over the port. And the UN is saying this should be in the hands of the United Nations. And the Houthis have agreed to that, and the Saudis have not. And why the Saudis haven't? Because it's the damn crown prince that doesn't want to be humiliated and wants to get a win, even if it is at the cost of the lives of millions of people in Yemen. So the U.S. has blood on its hands for what we are doing to support the Saudis, and it's also part of this war with Yemen, because Yemen was not in on this in the beginning, came in and are probably supporting the Houthis now, but basically they've gotten a lot of weapons that came from the United States that were there from the previous government, and now the Saudis are seeing it as a proxy war with Iran, and it has to end. So I think we have time for just a couple of other questions. Let's see how many hands. We have one, two, three, and then one, two, three, four, and then we'll wrap up if you could make yours.
Yeah, I was a little late, so if you've answered this, then just move right on. But I've always been amazed that there hasn't been an invasion of Iran yet, because it's just been rumbling for so long. Do you have any ideas why in the last 8 or 12 years when we constantly felt, you know, McCain saying bomb, bomb, Iran, and everything else, why we have actually held it back? Has it been people power or other stuff?
Well, I did talk about Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, and how within the military they understand how catastrophic it would be. Were you here when I discussed that? Okay, so I talked about that, but I just want to, on the issue of people power, to say that when, that you're right, when John McCain was singing the Beach Boys song to bomb, bomb, bomb Iran, there was a lot of people power at that time that in the ensuing years, especially when Obama was trying to get support for the Iran deal, the AIPAC and other groups were created out of nothing with a lot of money by Sheldon Adelson and others to try to have the Congress vote to deny Obama the ability to sign that deal. And they were not successful with that, and that is because of people power. Well, that's a very good question. And while I talked about how it's very hard to get people in Congress to take a good position on Iran, it is important to note that there are some conservative groups like the Cato, well, the Cato Institute is a libertarian group, but there's also FreedomWorks and there's the Koch brothers who don't want to see a war with Iran either. Don't think that would be particularly good for the Middle East and for the world economy. They have been working with some of the conservative Republicans like Mike Lee, the senator in Congress, who has been trying to stop the weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, for example. So there is the potential of that kind of a coalition, yes. Oh, but what, can I add one other thing to that? You would think with 80 million people and actually quite a potential to make a lot of money in Iran, that there would be the usual U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the business groups that would be lobbying. Amazingly, Iran is so toxic in the U.S. public opinion that these groups don't want to be known publicly as lobbying for lifting the sanctions.
I've seen some stuff online, basically that the CIA is involved with some of what's going on in Iran, you know, maybe means of giving us a reason to intervene. So
I think that you're absolutely right. While Iranians have very good reason to be very upset about the state of the economy and going out and protesting, and just like many of us here are very upset not only about the state of the economy, but all the money that is being spent on these wars overseas, and there are Iranians saying, why are you spending money on Syria and on Yemen instead of on our economy here? There still is the egging on by the U.S., and I'm sure the presence of the CIA. I was in Congress last week, and I go there when I'm home. I try to just even hang out in the cafeteria if there's not a good hearing to interrupt. And so I was sitting down. I had a shirt that said "Peace with Iran" on it, and these people called me over to a table, and they said, "What do you mean, peace with Iran?" And I said, "Who are you?" And around the table, they were members of all different minority groups in Iran. And lo and behold, they were funded by the National Endowment of Democracy to strengthen their organizations and to come to the U.S. to lobby on behalf of the minority groups and against the Iranian government. So, yes, they are there. And our money has been spent for decades now on covert activities inside Iran.
I'm responding to someone who said they admired seeing Medea in the halls of Congress, and I just want to say there's room in those halls for you, too. There might even be room if there's still a voting house. There's a place to stay. Bring your creativity, leave your inhibitions at home, and join them. I mean, you don't have to be a member of any club to do it. Just show up.
Well, that's a great way to end, and thank you so much, Robin, because... yes, there is a Code Pink House, and it is open to men, women, anybody who wants to come. There is no, you don't have to be a particularly intimate member of Code Pink, just anybody who wants to work on these activities. In fact, we open up the house to a lot of other organizations that come to do work on other issues, on environment or on LGBTQ rights or whatever. And so if you are interested, it's a place for people to come for like a week at a time. If you're working, you can take your vacation. If you're retired, you can just... come on over, and we will take you with us. You don't have to get arrested, but if you are interested in getting arrested, just to know if it's your first time, it's really easy. It's only $50, and it's like a parking ticket. Doesn't even go on your record, so come and join us. Now, for us who've done it a lot of times, it's more complicated, but that's why we need the newbies to come and join us. So thank you, Robin, for that, and we'd love to see you in Washington or on the streets of Chicago or anywhere else. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you'll buy a book and support your local independent bookstore. Thank you.